Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on destroyed legal arguments right after this message. Hey, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce. Government gets 60%. That means you get about $20,000 and the government gets $30,000. Now, isn't that just real special? But if you think that your share isn't enough, then why don't you work twice as hard, produce twice as much, and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year, and you're going to receive about 25%, and the government gets 75%. And now that means that we're for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net about $4,000 more. That's an 8% net take-home pay gain, and that's guaranteed by Congress and the IRS. So you produce twice as much, and you get 8% more of it. That's why I contend there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners. That's where you're at $100,000 a year. Top 5% of income earners, and then only net 25% of it. Why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour general law CD package, and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we pay so much and receive so little. To order your free general law CD package, just call direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Tax and Status School is also available on compact disc for adult home schooling. Why don't you call right now before you forget? That number again, 417-273-4967. Destroyed Arguments, written by Larry Beecraft back in 2000, is just as poignant and just as real today as it was 4 years ago. He said, "The purpose of this file is simply educational. I've noticed too many innocents who today believe that certain legal arguments, which were popular many years ago, but which were litigated by ill-prepared and desperate people, and then lost. To continue going down such dead-end roads and to follow these dead arguments will only result in disaster. But I do not think that the posting of this information, I believe, that all is lost and that there is no important legal issues left to argue. To the contrary, I have a very long list of solid legal issues which need to be litigated, and these are issues which will further our cause. For example, even though I post below the losses regarding some of these favorite issues of mine, the money issue, there are some good issues left, but they will be raised only in the best of circumstances and the best of cases. Some of these other issues are explained on my webpage, but I'm protecting these remaining issues from destruction by the desperate who grab onto these legal issues and then throw it into court. These folks have no plans nor legal skills to engage in the legal battle, and they slaughter our good issues." The first issue that he raises here, the money issue, he says that in the 1970s and early 80s, the advocates of the specie provisions in Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution made a concerted effort to educate people about this controversial provision. Consequently, people, mostly those who were desperate and ill-prepared, pro se litigants, began litigating the issue, and the courts have rendered the following adverse opinions on this issue. And he lists, let's see how many are in here, 13, 22 adverse opinions have been rendered on Article 1, Section 10. Let me give you a little background, and I'll tell you what my experience is. Nearly every day, somebody will call the law school, and they'll be talking about straw men and taxes in some regard, and that the income tax is unconstitutional, or that it's illegal or unlawful in some way. These are true, honest to God opinions and beliefs that people have. I don't doubt that these people are sincere and that they really believe it. Irwin Schiff, for instance, you know, I don't doubt that Irwin Schiff is sincere in his beliefs. The problem that we face, whether you're a layman or an attorney, is that many of these issues, in fact, nearly all of them, have already been litigated and they lost. And so if you lose a case, let's suppose that you go in with a legal argument to the judicial process and you raise this legal argument and you argue this legal argument and you go clear to the United States Supreme Court and you finally end up losing the case. Doesn't that send a signal then to everybody else in America that if you go in and make that same legal argument that you're going to lose also? Well, if it doesn't make that connection with you, let me tell you that that's the way that game is played. You know, once Roe v. Wade has been decided, that's the law of the land and every judge in the country is bound by it. Now, when the court takes up an issue on abortion, just as an illustration, it'll have to be something different than the original argument of Roe v. Wade. So when we start out with Roe v. Wade, can we have an abortion? Yes. Can we have an abortion funded by federal tax dollars? Yes. And what are the terms and circumstances? Well, it's spelled out, you know, in the first trimester, the second trimester, the third trimester, and so on. And so then a few years later, somebody comes up and they ask the exact identical question. Can you have an abortion? The answer is yes. And can it be paid for by federal tax dollars? Yes. And are there restraints and restrictions? Yes. First trimester, second trimester, and third trimester. That never changes. It always stays the same. The confusing factor for most lay people is that when the news media picks up on a abortion case, they'll cite Roe versus Wade, and the lay people out here, not being trained in law, after all, you go to public school, they teach you politics in public school, they don't teach law, they raise Roe v. Wade. And so in the average person's mind, Roe v. Wade, it's up for review again, and it's up for review again, and it's up for review again, and it's up for review again, you know, like a broken record. No, it isn't. It's not up for review again. There's a different issue that's being raised. Different issue. Some clarification of Roe v. Wade is in order. So the court agrees to take the case, and then they come along and they give you another guideline, another layer that goes on top of it. Can an abortion be performed in a private hospital and be paid for by federal tax money? Might be the second question that comes up. And then maybe a third issue comes up. Well, okay, if you can have an abortion in a private hospital that is paid for by federal tax money, could you have an abortion performed in some foreign country and have that paid for by U.S. tax dollars if the person involved is a American citizen? And then the court would answer that question and so on down the line. But it never affects the basic case originally decided. And this is what we call distinguishing cases. So another illustration of a distinguishing case is that in 1979, a case came up and had to do with identification called Brown versus Texas. And the court said, you don't have to identify yourself to a policeman. And there were factual circumstances surrounding the Brown case. Then, in 1985, a similar case came up called Lawson versus Colander. And the court reiterated in different circumstances, but that, no, you don't have to identify yourself to a police officer. Now, about 24 states in the union have statutes that require that you tell the police officer your name and at least your name. We'll leave out address and phone number and social security number, and that's another issue, but you have to identify yourself. Well, out in Nevada, a case came up just this year, 2004, and the court distinguished Brown and Colander by adding another particular. In a case where a policeman doesn't just happen upon an event, but is actually called out by somebody to investigate, and he asks you your name, you have to tell him at least your name. And then the court went on in the case and brought up some examples of some exceptions. Well, for instance, let's try this. Let's suppose that you're in Nevada, and this is one of the 24 states that require that you give your name at least to the police officer. When he's investigating, he doesn't just happen along on a fishing expedition. While the statute says that you have to give him your name, could there be some exceptions to the rule? Let's suppose the policeman says, now, I'm here investigating a crime, and you have a right to remain silent, and you have a right to an attorney present, and now he's given you your Miranda warning. You have a right to remain silent. Now, what's your name? Well, now's the time for you to say to the policeman, since I have a Fifth Amendment right to protect, I'm going to remain silent until I have my attorney present before I answer any questions. There would be an example of an exception. Or what if the policeman comes up to you and says, what's your name? And you ask this question. You say, well, is this a criminal investigation? And he answers, yes, this is a criminal investigation. And you say, well, if this is a criminal investigation, I don't want to talk to you. Period. You see, there are but-steps in the law. There are exceptions in the law. But once you've gotten beyond that but-sept and the court's made a decision, we all have a duty at that point in time to follow the law as the court gives it to us. I mean, after all, that's what courts are for. The legislature gives us the statute or the law, and then the court comes along and delineates the exceptions to the rule. Yes, in Nevada, you have to identify yourself to a policeman. So about 99.9% of the time, when the policeman comes along, for instance, let's suppose that there's a traffic accident, and he walks up to you and he says, I'm investigating this traffic accident, and I need your name, address, and phone number. You could be a potential witness here. And you say, I ain't talking to you, and I'm not going to identify myself. Well, you're not under criminal investigation. So if you say, as a witness, that I'm not going to make any statements and I'm not going to identify myself, you're in violation of that statute. There isn't any legitimate or logical reason why you as a citizen shouldn't be expected to testify to or reveal what you saw, what you heard, and what you know about a traffic accident or some other crime or some other event that transpired. So there's no protection under the Fifth Amendment for a witness who's being asked to identify himself. The identification of yourself is not of and by itself protected by the Fourth Amendment. That's the bottom line. But under certain circumstances, it could be. And it's up to you to know what those circumstances are. So it's up to you to have some kind of or some amount of legal knowledge and understanding so that you can function in a civilized society, especially here in the United States. Now, getting back to Larry, in his destroyed arguments, which you can get off of Larry B. Craft's website, just look up Larry B. Craft, B-E-E-C-R-A-F-T, Larry B. Craft, and I think you'll find him on the website. Pretty interesting guy. He's an attorney down in Huntsville, Alabama, and he's spent about, 30 years since I first met him out in, when I first met him, was out in Colorado in the early 1980s. And we happened to be working on a job together, and he went back to Alabama, I went back to Idaho, and meanwhile, time has passed, and he has done a lot of neat cases in income tax. He specializes pretty much in income tax, and so pretty nice guy, and he's taken up the opposite side of the issue. For instance, when people call here and they write me an email, if you don't get an answer, it's because I'm not going to answer or try to answer the negative side of an issue. Can you prove to me that the income tax is constitutional? I wouldn't waste the time of day trying to prove to you that the income tax is constitutional. You might as well write me an email and say, can you prove the sky is blue? Can you prove that up is in that direction? I'm not going to sit here and argue with you over whether the earth is round or up is up and down is down and the income tax is constitutional. That's the negative side of the issue. What you're saying is, I want you to prove this negative. It's argumentative is what it is. And so those of us in law said, well, we're not going to sit here and argue with arguments. But Larry took the time to do that. Now, it's possible to do that. I mean, I guess I could sit down here and prove to you that the income tax is constitutional by citing a number of cases where the Supreme Court has said the income tax is constitutional. The income tax is constitutional. I guess I could do that, but I wouldn't waste the time. Larry took his time to do that, and so I thought I'd share that with you and show you that the way to succeed in the courtroom is you do what the winners do and you avoid what the losers do. Now, let me give you a little background. Back in the 1960s, when this tax protest thing started to heat up, it actually started in 1944 with a guy named A.J. Porth. That's where the modern tax protest movement began. 1944, right after the repeal of the withholding provision of the income tax, which was enacted in 1942 when World War II began. But it started to heat up about 1964. So from 64 to 84, about 20 years, the court, that is the U.S. Supreme Court and the circuit courts of appeal at the federal level, took on a number of income tax challenges. And there have been a number of income tax questions and challenges that have arisen from 1984 to the present day, and they probably will continue for the next 100 years, as long as there's an income tax. But once the court answers that particular question, or delineates the standards by which we're going to go down that slippery slope, you know, it could be a Fifth Amendment return. There is a thing called a Fifth Amendment return. And that Fifth Amendment return could be utilized by maybe one person in 100, maybe. In 21 years that I've been teaching law, I've only had one student come in here in 21 years that had a legitimate Fifth Amendment return position. He used it, and it worked. I've only had one. But as a general rule, you have hundreds and thousands of people every year, nationwide in the United States, filing Fifth Amendment returns, which have been ruled on by the courts many, many times. There is a standard that you have to follow to file a Fifth Amendment return. And if you can meet those standards and fill that status, then you too can file a Fifth Amendment return. But as a general rule, that's not applicable. It's very rare. But you have thousands of people doing that, and these thousands of people lose. They get into litigation and they lose. And oftentimes they go to prison. They end up divorced. They lose their homes. They lose their jobs, careers. And you know, if you're a professional, say you're a chiropractor, a doctor, dentist, lawyer, or something like that, and you get a felony conviction like tax evasion, then you can't practice that profession anymore. They lock you out. Not entirely clear why we'd want to do that, you know, but we do in this country. So if you're a doctor and you get convicted for tax evasion, you'll lose your license to practice medicine for the rest of your life. That's an additional punishment, probably a worse punishment than the jail time and the taxes you got to pay or the penalties. So tuck that one away in your heart. Let me take a look at the first argument he brings up here called the money issue. And let's give you a couple of three cases here. In K-O-L-L, I guess that's Coal, versus Wayzata State Bank, cited at 397, Fed Second, 124, here in the Eighth Circuit, clear back in 1968. They took up the money issue. Article 1, Section 10. And that money issue has taken on many different lives, many different facets. People will come in and say, well, I didn't get any gold when I borrowed that money from the bank, so therefore I don't have to pay the loan back because I don't have any gold to pay it back with. That issue was answered one time in a case called Ronnie L. Nixon, in which the court said, well, you borrowed credit, pay credit back. You borrowed bubble gum, pay bubble gum back. That's what the bottom line is. But in taxes, typically, they'll say, well, since we don't have any gold coin, we can't pay our income tax because Article 1, Section 10 prohibits me from using anything but gold or silver coin. Now, here's this same person making the argument, I can't pay my income tax because I don't have any gold or silver coin, but he can pay his house payment without gold and silver coin. He can pay his car payment. He can buy groceries down at Safeway. And the courts, when they take a look at people like that, they say, you know, your argument is specious, frivolous, without foundation or merit. Judges like to use big words like that because it makes them sound real smart. Erudite, they call it. But in any event, the bottom line is, does your argument really make sense? I mean, I'm on a gold standard and I deal in gold and silver coin, and when you come to law school here, we charge tuition here in gold coin. If you don't have gold coin, you don't go to school here. That's all. So if I were to make the argument that I don't use Federal Reserve notes for whatever reason, and I don't have a bank account and so on, I've got a different legal argument than some guy who's working for a corporation like General Motors and getting a paycheck every week and depositing his check in the bank and then making an argument, well, you can't make me pay an income tax because I don't have any gold coin or Article 1, Section 10. So the courts have ruled, and in this case here on the money issue, and Larry Beecraft now has cited 22 cases. I'll just give you a couple of three names, and then if you want to chase them out, United States versus Daly, 481 Fed Second, page 28. Milam, M-I-L-A-M, versus United States, 524 Fed Second, 629. That gives you three cases right off the top out of 22 on the money issue. Now, that doesn't mean, and Larry pointed this out, he said, that doesn't mean that there aren't some legitimate issues to be raised over Article 1, Section 10, the money issue, gold and silver coin, but not by desperate people without any legal training who are glomming on to arguments that have already been brought into court and litigated. Now, I mentioned that from 1964 to 84, the courts in that heyday of tax protests looked at about 100 cases a year. I mean, nationwide, they had thousands of tax protesters, and they would look at 100 issues a year. Now, that's not the same issue, but it's a different issue with each case. Some little nuance that some guy raised that was a little different. Well, if gold and silver is the issue, well, could I use French francs if they were gold? Or why can't I use... Why can't I use gold certificates to pay my taxes? Or, you know, it could be any one of 100 different variations of that. So the courts were pretty liberal. If you all remember, this was the era of the Burger Court and the Warren Court, you know, back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. So the court, being very liberal, took all these issues on, and they made 2,000 decisions. 100 a year for 20 years is about 2,000. And when the smoke cleared, by about 1985, the smoke cleared. There are three viable defenses to an income tax charge. The courts have said, look, if you can come in here and show reliance under Murdoch, that you relied in good faith, for instance, upon the representations or the advice of your tax preparer or your tax attorney or something like that, That's an affirmative defense to tax evasion. Reliance. Then in 1979, a guy by the name of Aiken came up with a novel argument. He said, well, I read Irwin Schiff's book or somebody else like that, and it was copyrighted, and I relied upon that advice, and because I relied upon that advice, now I find myself being prosecuted criminally, and I think that that's unreasonable. The United States should not copyright and protect lies and fraud. And then when we rely upon that because it's copyrighted, we get prosecuted. And so the First Circuit took a look at that and said, well, yeah, we'll buy into that. We think that makes some sense. And the Ninth Circuit said, no, we're not going to do that. So about 1990, a guy by the name of Cheek comes along with the reliance defense. And this fellow Cheek, by the way, had been one of my students years ago, back in 1983. And he made that argument, that Aiken claim, combined with Murdoch, and the Supreme Court of the United States said, yeah, we think that makes sense, and so they rectified the circuit. So now you've got reliance. The basic argument is reliance. I relied upon somebody else, but in a little different context. You know, I was relying upon my attorney, and now I was relying upon this copyrighted book that I've got. Now, what if the book was not copyrighted? What if you came in and you said, well, my defense is I relied upon this book, but it's not copyrighted. Well, I don't know. The court didn't say that they would accept an uncopyrighted book, but they said if the book is copyrighted. That was the key in Aiken. So that's another issue or another story for another day, isn't it? Somebody else will have to come along and the court will have to rule on, well, what if the book isn't copyrighted? And then the third is religious free exercise. For instance, the Amish are exempted from Social Security because they don't have Social Security numbers. And so many people believe that they should be exempted from the tax because if the Amish can be exempted from the tax because they're Amish, well, then I ought to be. Well, that doesn't fly because you're not Amish. You're Catholic. And then somebody will come along and say, well, that's religious discrimination. What's discriminatory about it? Amish people have peculiar beliefs. Catholic people have peculiar beliefs. It just happens that the Catholic Church doesn't have any objection to Social Security, and the Amish do. And the same thing is true with conscientious objector status. You know, Amish people don't go into the military. They object to that, and Catholic people don't. So, you know, the courts come along and Congress comes along and we live in a civilized society and we have to accommodate the Amish and the Catholics and the Protestants and the Jews and the Muslims and everybody else. And so the courts come along with policy decisions. That's what appellate courts do. They create policy. They don't come along and say, we're not going to have abortion. They come along and say, okay, we're going to have abortion and here are the rules that we have to follow in order to comply with our Constitution or with the statutes that Congress is enacting. There's an interesting case as I speak. Out in California, there's a law that they enacted out there, state statute, authorizing medical marijuana, which happens to violate federal statute. That case was just taken up by the Supreme Court the other day, and they'll issue an opinion here in, you know, a few months. They'll come back and they'll say, well, yes, federal law is going to prevail in this case, or no, state law is going to prevail in this case, and the case is predicated upon the Commerce Clause at Article 1, Section 8, which I thought was pretty interesting. I don't know how the court is going to rule, but they should rule in favor of California's medical marijuana law because it doesn't affect interstate commerce. Now, the court's going to take up, how does private growing of marijuana affect the marijuana market commercially in the United States? That's what that case is going to turn on. Commerce Clause, just like Wickard versus Filburn. And you can pretty well predict how the court's going to rule. Now, if I was going to bet money, I would bet money, based on what I've heard so far, and I haven't read any briefs, so I ought not to be betting, but if the news media has given us some straight skinny here, they've reported the case fairly accurately. Medical marijuana grown in the state of California, which does not cross state lines, should not be in commerce, and it shouldn't affect the commercial price of marijuana, because marijuana is illegal everywhere. There isn't any commercial market for marijuana, period. Now, that's what I would rule. Now, let's watch and see what the court comes down with. And you'll find, when you read the decision, it's going to be a very well-reasoned, logical conclusion. Those nine justices are all going to write a paper as to how they view medical marijuana in California affecting interstate commerce in the marketplace concerning the price of marijuana in Maryland and New York and North Dakota. And then they're going to come back and say, well, it doesn't affect it one way or the other, and the law is constitutional, and the federal government has to butt out. Now, that's the way I would rule, I think. And on the other hand, they may come back and say, well, my God, look at what this does to the marijuana price, even though it's illegal. And they'll come back with a well-reasoned, logical argument. And that's going to be the law of the land. And however they rule, then the rest of us are all bound by that decision. That's the way our government works, the way our system of law and order works. And if you don't follow that system, you have anarchy. You used to have a bunch of honyakers marching around on the streets burning cars. That's what you got in Iraq. Anarchy. That's what you're about to see over in what's that little country over there? Just had an election here. That isn't Uzbekistan, but some Russian, former Russian republic or country over there. And they're out there marching around, didn't like the results of the election, and so they're parading around on the streets. Now, so far, they're fairly peaceable, but, you know, one of these days it'll break into civil war. You know, nobody wants that. So when Al Gore butted out of the election back in 2000 and said, well, I'll butt out in favor of George Bush, wasn't because George Bush won. Gore actually did the country a favor. So what do you want to do, have a civil war over this election? All right, so Bush took over for 4 years, and then we had another election. Well, this time Bush won pretty sizably. In other words, it was close, but it was decisive. And so, all right, so now that's the solution. Now, all the Democrats will follow along, in our country at least. They'll follow along. They won't like Bush. I don't like Bush either, but on other grounds. But we'll follow along. We're not going to revolt in the streets and start setting off car bombs like they do in Iraq. Now, when people raise the income tax, they call on the telephone and they say, well, the government is oppressing me, or they're doing this, that, or something else. When we're talking about the subject matter now of Article 1, Section 10, not only has the United States Supreme Court and the Circuit Courts of Appeal weighed in on the subject, but also there are a number of state Supreme Courts that have weighed in on it. Here are some adverse state decisions from states like Minnesota, Oregon, Alaska. Let's see who else is here. Mississippi, Arkansas, Maryland. I mean, and there's 26 of those. So you get 22 federal cases, 26 state cases that all have something to say, some decision to be made on Article 1, Section 10, the gold and silver clause of our federal constitution. So when it's all said and done, to argue Article 1, Section 10 in an income tax case is the kiss of death. It's a waste of your time, effort, and energy, and you can just forget it. And besides that, the income tax is based upon unjust weights and balances. The income tax is a tax on Federal Reserve notes because Federal Reserve notes violate Leviticus 19:35 and 36. The essence of it is you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. And Deuteronomy 25:13 through 16. The income tax is the penalty that we pay because we won't pay God's tithe. Now, that's the bottom line to it. Let's take a look at a second one over here. The IRS is a Delaware corporation. Now, I first heard that back about 1982 or 3 or 4. Somebody came into my office and said, hey, did you know that the IRS is a Delaware corporation? And I read the paperwork and I said, gosh, you know, if that's true, that's important. You know, that's like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, or the private, the private corporation, or the corporate status, I shouldn't say private, but the corporate status of the post office or something like that. Now, the State Department isn't a corporation, but the Postal Service is. And could that have some impact upon the court's decision if you came in, made your argument, said, well, wait a minute, they can't make this argument because, let me give you an illustration here. One time I was operating a corporation selling furniture out in the West, and so I sold some furniture to a guy out in Wyoming, furniture store out there, and he in turn sold that furniture to some Indians who were living on an Indian reservation. Well, these Indians living on the Indian reservation didn't pay for the furniture that they bought from the merchant in one of these little towns, Riverton, Wyoming or someplace. And so a legal question arises. Well, how do we get paid by these Indians who live on the Indian reservation? And the answer is you don't. You don't get paid. Because as a corporation, I can't sue those Indians on that Indian reservation. I don't know if that's right or wrong or good or bad. It's certainly bad for me. It's bad for the merchant. It's bad, you know, for a number of reasons, but that's why when you go into a merchant and you want to buy something on time, you have to fill out a credit application. The merchant wants to know, are you an Indian that lives on the Indian reservation? And if I sell you this furniture, you're going to bring it out to your home on the Indian reservation, and then you're not going to pay me, and there's nothing I can do about that. So I'm not going to sell to you. Does that mean we discriminate against Indians? No, not at all. And you Indians out there, hey, listen, it's nothing personal, but I don't know you from Adam. Now, if you're a white guy or a black guy or any other color guy and you don't live on an Indian reservation and you're not protected by some treaty, you know, that was enacted 100 years ago or 200 years ago, I can sue you. I can bring you into court. I can put a lien on your paycheck every week. You know, I can take your car or your house, make you pay me, or give me back my furniture. So those are some of the legal vagaries that go on in America. And I'm sitting here saying, well, you know, the Indian says, well, that sounds good to me. And the merchant says, well, that don't sound very good to me, so I'm not going to sell to Indians out there. Well, after we got burned once, we had to put in a new company policy. We don't sell to Indians that live on reservations. That's all. We don't sell to Indians that live on reservations. Period. No, not on time. Yeah. You walk in, put your money on the counter, we'll sell to you all day long. All right, so here's the bottom line. The laws are made, and then the laws are construed by the courts, and there are policies that are made, and we have to live by and follow those policies. I didn't throw myself on the floor and have a temper tantrum because I couldn't collect from that Indian, and that Indian, he probably knew that we couldn't collect from him, and he took us for a ride, and he was a thief, and he was dishonest, and that's wrong. But you know, there's a lot of wrongs that go on in life, and income tax is one of those wrongs, and a lot of people get ground up in the legal machinery because they're ignorant of the law. So when someone comes to you and they says, well, Article 1, Section 10 of our Constitution spells out gold and silver coin, and they make some kind of an argument, you can take that kind of argument with a grain of salt. Grain of salt. Now he goes on to say, this is Larry Becraft, I wish to ultimately win this issue, that is the money issue, but to do so will require experienced legal scholarship. A scholar who knows what he is doing. And the only person in America who should be in charge of money issue litigation is Dr. Edwin Vieira. You can see one of his articles posted on my main page. One of the goals of the Wallace Institute is to raise sufficient funds to turn Dr. Vieira loose to litigate this issue and win. I would second that. Now, Dr. Vieira has written a number of books. The best one is called Pieces of Eight. It's published by the Sound Dollar Committee. Sound Dollar Committee called Pieces of Eight. I don't know where you're going to get a copy of it and go to Barnes & Noble and see if it's still in print. You could go to Larry Becraft's website and see if you could pick it up there. Or if you really get desperate and you can't find it there, you could send me an email and I'll look it up and probably answer your email. I don't know right off the top of my head. I've got one here published back in the 1980s. Dr. Vieira lives back east. I think he's in Maryland or someplace like that. And he's an attorney, scholar, probably the best legal mind in the country when it talks when we're talking about Article 1, Section 8, or excuse me, Article 1, Section 10. Gold and silver coin, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. At least that's Beecraft's opinion, and it's my opinion, so you can take it from there. Talking about the IRS being a Delaware corporation, back in 1982 or 83, somebody started circulating the argument that the IRS was a private corporation, which had been created in Delaware in 1933. Now, if it was created only in 1933, then why do we have the following appropriations for this agency found in acts of Congress 10 years before 1933? For instance, in 42 Statute 375, which was enacted on February the 17th, 1922, 42 Statute 454, March 20th, 1922, 42 Statute 1096, January 3rd, 1923. And he goes on and cites a bunch more, you know, such as 45 Statute 168, 1928, so on. Now, there actually was a corporation called the IRS. I researched this out years ago. I'll just pass it on to you. Because that could be pretty important if the IRS actually wasn't a federal agency, you know, like the Treasury Department or, you know, like your county, Humboldt County, California, or whatever. So I researched it out, and indeed there was a corporation called the IRS, and I forgot what it was. It was a legitimate corporation, it's just that they had the same name. They used IRS as their name. And I don't know, they made dishes or they made pottery or something like that. And there was actually that corporation. So when they came along and they said, hey, the IRS was incorporated in Delaware in, oh, I forgot the year now, it was around 1933. That was true, but it wasn't the IRS that collects taxes, which is a government bureaucracy which was created by Congress and it's an arm of the Treasury Department to collect taxes. It's not the same outfit. And people have gone into court making that argument. Well, and obviously they didn't do a very good job of doing legal research. You know, your common sense would say, hey, you gotta start looking this up. So I looked up the Delaware Corporation and I wanted their charter. In fact, I got their charter. And you can do the same thing. That charter, if you were to write to the Secretary of State of Delaware and ask for the charter of the IRS incorporated in 1933, he'll send it to you. He'll charge you $5, as I recall, charge you $5 to get a copy of it. I imagine you could do that online now. I did this many years ago before we had computers and didn't know what they were for. All right, so the IRS is a Delaware corporation. This is indeed a frivolous argument, and it has been properly rejected by the courts. You can see that in Young versus IRS, 596 Federal Supplement 141. And the real issue is whether the IRS has been created by law. So here's Beecraft, lawyer. Now he comes along and he says, you know, we would do better if we argued, came into court and said, has the IRS been properly created by the Congress? I remember some cases that came down, and this is a little trick that you might keep in mind. It's called the OMB number. Well, back in the 1980s, President Reagan got a law enacted by Congress concerning, I think it was called the Paperwork Reduction Act or something on that order, and requiring that the federal government, when they give you a form, that they have an OMB number on there, make an official piece of paper over there. Well, If the government doesn't have an OMB number, then it's not a proper form and you don't have to fill it out. That's the bottom line. And there have been some winning cases along that line. The government agency, you know, probably went down to Kinko's and got some forms made up and they're not legal because they don't have an OMB number on them. So, you know, the government has to follow the law. And agencies of government oftentimes do not follow the law. But then it doesn't make any difference. because there aren't any people out there doing business with government that know what the law is, and even if they did, they wouldn't know how to make the government comply with the law. They wouldn't have a clue as to how to file a prohibition or a mandamus. So, for practical purposes, for most of you lay people out there, it doesn't make any difference. Just sit down, shut up, fold your hands, and ride the back of the bus. Now, occasionally you'll run across some iconoclast, you know, that says, well, wait a minute, I think maybe I don't want to follow that. I want the government to obey the law. That was my conclusion back in the 80s. I said, you know, the government has to follow the law just like all the rest of us. That's what got me started in law, and that's what I've been doing ever since. That's why I'm a civil rights advocate. That's why I operate a law school. That's why I teach lay people how to make the government obey the law. So if the government's breaking the law in their attempt to enforce the law, that's illegal. You ought to call them on it. Just like the Indian that bought the furniture. Now, let's suppose that the Indian knew the law. Well, it wasn't his fault that George Gordon didn't know the law and the merchant didn't know the law, was it? Sure, he was dishonest and sure he stole my furniture, but, you know, if I want to get out here in the marketplace and do business and trade commerce, business, and industry, don't you think I ought to know the law? I used to operate a truck. I'll pass a little story on to you. I used to operate a truck. And I noticed that when my truck, the Atlantis Manufacturing Company furniture truck, came to a weigh station and I pulled in, I would be following a Yellow Freighter, a Garrett Freighter, some big company truck, and the green light would come on and that truck would just sail through the scales. When my truck got up on the scale, I would always get the red light. If I was behind another private trucking operator, I would always notice that he would get the red light. I suspected that there was some kind of a sweetheart deal made by these highway patrolmen operating the scales and the big trucking companies and then the little independent truckers. So the big trucks, they never came out and checked their brakes and checked their horns and checked their equipment and logbooks to see if they were up to date. But all of us little private guys, I mean, they'd come out there and put on their coveralls and crawl underneath our trucks. They're going to find something. And these fines were amounting to about $600 a week for my little company, $2,500 a month, you know, $2,500 a month, you know, times... It's $5,000 every 2 months, five times six, $30,000 a year. Well, okay, so our company's getting fined about $30,000 a year, and so we just add that into the price of our product. It's the cost of doing business. Just like your payroll taxes and everything else, you just roll it into your price of your product. But I'll tell you, I was on a trip one time to Salt Lake City making my rounds, and I got down to the Burley weigh station, and they not only called me in, but they found that the trailer brakes weren't working and the horn didn't work. And so he wrote me up a ticket and he said, you got to get that fixed. Well, I never was opposed to getting it fixed. I always tried to keep the truck within, you know, the proper weight and all the proper equipment on it. And, you know, I did everything I could, you know, to keep the truck up to standards. And this highway cop down there, he said, you're not moving that truck till it's fixed. And I said, well, how am I going to get it fixed unless I can go back to Burley and take it into a shop and have it repaired? And he said, you can have a mechanic come out here and fix it. Now, it's about 14 miles back to Burley. So the mechanic has got to come all the way out, look at my truck, go all the way back and get parts and come all the way back and fix it and then drive all the way back. I got to pay for all of that. There's no big safety issue here with the general public, but that's what they... Oh, you can't move that truck. Why, you're going to kill somebody. Why, that's a safety problem. See? They give you that song and dance. You know, it's just crap. They know it and you know it. And everybody else knows it, but what are you going to do? That changed my life. I don't know who you are, Mr. Highway Cop, but you changed my life. I said, you know, that's unreasonable. That's arbitrary and capricious governmental power being used against me for no legitimate or intelligent purpose. So I had to call the mechanic, and I didn't get out of there till 2 o'clock the next day. Now this, remember, is about 7, 8 o'clock at night. Now next morning, you know, I gotta call this mechanic, and he comes out, and he goes through this, and so I'm held up here, you know, for nearly a whole day. So I was going down the road thinking about that, and one day I was in a truck stop, and I was kind of grousing, and another trucker told me, he said, "Don't you know that there's a book published that shows you with a map every way station in the United States of America and the back county roads that go around it?" I said, no, I didn't know that. So I went into the bookstore and the truck stop, and I said, "Have you got this book?" And yeah, for $6.95. And from that day forward, I never crossed another way station scale. I never drove into another way station from 1979 to 1981. I never paid another fine from that day on. I figured, well, one of these days they'll catch me, you know, in one of these roving way stations. You know, that's where they got a pickup, and they run around on the highways, and they'll catch a truck, you know, on a backcountry road somewhere, and they say, "Well, this guy's running this truck on this backcountry road because he's overweight." And so they got these portable scales, and they flag you down. And I say, "Well, one of these days maybe I'll get caught." But, you know, the worst thing that can happen when they catch me, they're going to give me a ticket. And meanwhile, I'm saving $600 a week. Now, remember, I'm paying fines. This is really just a tax. The way they do that is they pick on all the little trucking companies, little guys, have 1, 2, 5 trucks. And they stop those guys and they rake them over the coals and they give them these fines, the big trucking companies. You know, like Garrett and so on, Yellow Freight and so on, they don't bother them. And so this is big government benefiting big corporate business at the expense of the little guys. So don't ever kid yourself, the government is out there protecting the people. The government is out there protecting big business. That's their mission in life, that's what they're there for, and that's what the highway patrolman is there to enforce. The protection of big business. Don't forget that. All right, I got a couple of minutes left. We'll start off here with the IMF argument. IMF. Some people contend that the Secretary of the Treasury is in reality a foreign agent under the control of the International Monetary Fund. This argument has been rejected by the courts. In United States versus Rosh, R-O-S-N-O-W, I guess that's Ross now, 977 Fed Second, 399. That was decided in 1992. United States versus Jagim, J-A-G-I-M, 978 Fed Second, 1032. United States versus Higgins, 987 Fed Second, 543. Now, let's take a look at this, the IMF argument. Some contend that the Secretary of the Treasury is in reality a foreign agent under the control of the IMF. This argument has been rejected by the courts. Let's suppose that that argument was true, accurate, and correct, and that in reality the Secretary of the Treasury is an agent of the IMF. You've been charged with willful failure to file. Can you tell me what is the logical nexus between your failure to file your tax return and some crime that's being committed by the Secretary of the Treasury? And I presume that's what the argument is. Well, the Secretary of the Treasury, he's a criminal, and he didn't take his oath of office, or he's a double agent, and it's prohibited by statute or something. And let me back up for a minute. That's the equivalent of the highway patrolman comes up, and he gives you a ticket for speeding. You find out that the highway patrolman is a wife beater. So you come into trial, and as your defense to the speeding charge, you allege that this speeding charge should be dismissed because the policeman is a wife beater. Now, we've been in the legal process, or the legal system, the legal business in this country for 200 years. We started this, you know, back in 1787. Cases started coming out of our Supreme Court about 1794. You go back to old cases like Wallace reports and Peters reports and so on. I mean, hell, they didn't have typewriters. You know, they just wrote everything down. Those are handwritten. Did you know that? Handwritten notes. And then they're printed in books. And we go back long before we had stenographers, you know. And I can't ever find anywhere in American jurisprudence where the fact that the policeman or somebody else is a criminal justifies your criminal behavior. It's never been the law. It's never been our system in the United States of America. So, oftentimes when you find out, well, gosh, you shouldn't make me pay this loan back because the government doesn't give us gold and silver coin. Now, I agree that our government is criminal in not having gold and silver coin in circulation from 1933 to 1987, but they corrected that in 1987. Here in America, we have our gold and silver coin back. I don't know if you're aware of that. We have it back. They took it away from us from 33 to 87. And that was a criminal activity. It should not have been, but it was. Now, I don't make these laws, and because I don't make these laws, I can't sit here and argue that, but I'm pointing out to you that the government was breaking the law from 1933 to 1987, but in 1987 they corrected that error, and from 1987 until today, we now have our gold and silver back, and they're in compliance with Article 1, Section 10. There's no argument to be made there. And conversely, if the Secretary of the Treasury over here is in reality a foreign agent, and let's suppose that that's true, accurate, and correct, and he's a dirty criminal, maybe a felon, and maybe he should be prosecuted and put in prison, and removed from office, because he's a bad guy, what in the world's that got to do with you filing a tax return? Or income tax evasion, or whatever it is that you may be charged with? So making the argument that somebody else is a criminal or that the government is breaking the law over here isn't going to hold any water. The better argument to be made, you know, during the period from 1933 to 1987 when government was breaking the law and they took our gold and silver away, if in fact it was a breach of the law, I never saw any cases that anybody was ever able to argue intelligently in that period of time to bring them back into compliance, somebody should have written a mandamus, I guess. Somebody should have written a prohibition, an extraordinary remedy, and taken it in and said, hey, look what the government's doing. This violates our Constitution. Let's get this thing straightened around. You know, there's 1,000 issues out there, boys and girls, and when you've got issues out there, they ought to be addressed. And George Gordon is not going to address every issue, and neither is Larry Beecraft. But Beecraft is addressed about 20 of these issues, and we covered 3 of them here so far. I got a minute left here to close, and I got to split and leave the scene. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. But the IMF argument is a dead letter issue. The IRS as a Delaware corporation is a dead letter issue. And Article 1, Section 10, at least in about 22 and 26, what is that? 22, 26, be 48. 20, 46, 8, 48 cases, both state and federal, is a dead letter issue. So before you make those kinds of frivolous arguments, make sure that you do your legal research. At least come in with something new, unusual, and different. All right, I'm about out of time. You have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Hey, there's the signal. It says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then. Good night, friends.